stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Abundant issues surround the G20. As the G20 summit gets underway in Hangzhou, China, President Obama and Prime Minister Theresa May met to talk about a number of issues, including the Syrian civil war. The Prime Minister said she will urge Russia to clear the way for civilians in need of help.
It's vital that humanitarian supplies get to innocent Syrians who are in desperate need. And this afternoon, I will urge President Putin to do all he can to get the aid convoys in and to end the indiscriminate bombing of civilians.
Secretary of State John Kerry, also at the summit, telling reporters that the talks between the U.S. and Russia are proceeding cautiously.
I've said all along we're not going to rush and we're not going to do something that we think has less than what we believe is a legitimate opportunity to be able to try to get the job done.
According to a televised interview before President Obama left for the summit, he claims he'll be telling China it needs to adopt a more responsible role on the world stage and adhere to international norms. President Obama told CNN in an interview broadcast today that Beijing needs to show restraint in its relations with smaller countries, especially as it deals with territorial disputes in the South China Sea. The American leader said that with increasing power comes increasing responsibilities. Obama said the U.S. has urged China to accept international rules that build a strong worldwide order. Bangladesh has executed a senior Islamist leader, Mir Qasem Ali, who was found guilty of war crimes during the 1971 war in which Bangladesh broke away from Pakistan. Ali was convicted on 8 charges that included the abduction and killing of a young man in a torture cell, which the Bangladesh government says eventually resulted in the deaths of 3 million people. This is VOA News. President Obama assured Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Sunday that Washington is committed to bringing the perpetrators of that failed July coup against his government to justice. But he stopped short of saying the U.S. would extradite the Muslim cleric that Ankara blames for the coup.
I've assured him that our Justice Department and my national security team will continue to cooperate with Turkish authorities to determine how we can make sure that those who carried out these activities are brought to justice and reaffirm our strong support for the Turkish people and Turkish institutions.
Turkey contends that 75-year-old Fethullah Gulen, living in self-imposed exile since 1999 in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania, orchestrated the coup, although he adamantly has denied any involvement. President Erdogan, sitting right across the table from President Obama, indicated that efforts were underway to gather evidence from the attempted coup. He said the post-attempted coup documentation and evidence therein will be amassed, and they will be submitted to our friends in the United States. The efforts are still underway. We had welcomed a delegation from the American Justice Department, and a similar delegation from the Turkish Ministry of Justice will go to the United States. President Obama and Erdogan met on the sidelines of the G20 summit. Republican U.S. presidential nominee Donald Trump said at a predominantly black church in Detroit on Saturday he wanted to help rebuild the city, and there are many wrongs that should be made right in the United States. 2 months before the election, Mr. Trump is struggling to attract African American and other minority voters.
Those who seek office do not do enough to step into the community and learn what is going on. I'm here today to learn.
Mr. Trump's appearance was not appreciated by everyone. Mr. Trump has spent much, if not all, of his campaign talking to overwhelmingly white audiences, where he's made condescending remarks about people of color. Inside the church, Mr. Trump said the nation needs a civil rights agenda of our time with better education and good jobs. Pope Francis has declared Mother Teresa a saint in highlight of his holy year of mercy. During a canonization ceremony today in front of tens of thousands of people at St. Peter's Square, as Pope Francis declared Mother Teresa a saint. A Nobel Prize winner, she was known during her lifetime as the Saint of the Gutters for her work among the poorest of the poor in India, arriving in Calcutta in 1929. When she died in 1997, her only possessions were her Bible, her prayer beads, and her sari. She was put on the fast track to becoming a saint by John Paul II. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clottier in Washington.
If we are committed to maintain peace as a country, both parties must listen to each other, and we must rush into coming up with a solution that will break the peace of this country.
The Zambian Constitutional Court continues the hearing of a petition challenging the re-election of incumbent President Edgar Lungu.
Looking at Gabon and our most recent findings, we find that people are very concerned about the freeness and fairness of elections, showing that of the 36 African countries that we surveyed, Gabonese people have the lowest amount of trust in election institutions.
A new survey shows that majority of the citizens of Gabon favor multi-party competition and presidential term limits.
It's a key concern that remains in Somalia that journalists cannot operate more freely. And over the last 6 months, there is a new trend that seems to appear in a couple of states in Somalia, which is that journalists are being harassed in the streets.
And a new report warns restrictions on freedom of expression threaten Somalia's political stability. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian Constitutional Court will on Monday continue hearing a petition by the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, challenging the re-election of incumbent President Edgar Lungu. But some Zambians say the court undermined the constitution. This after the court initially ruled that the petition hearing should be concluded within the first 14 days, which expired last Friday. For more on the election petition, I reached Louise Mwapi, the executive director for the Zambian Council for Social Development.
I think for me, first of all, what we must know is that the election result in its current status, without being petitioned, it tells us that, the two giants have almost 50-50 following. And that being said, if we are committed to maintain peace as a country, both parties must listen to each other, and we must rush into coming up with a solution that will break the peace of this country. I think the court so wise enough to come up with the decisions that they came up with.
It appears the ruling party is displeased with the ruling of the court postponing the election petition case, which they had initially ruled that it should be concluded in 14 days. Some have accused the judges of breaking the same constitution that they are supposed to protect and uphold, and that postponing the petition hearing to this week is unconstitutional and illegal. What is your take?
Well, first of all, how illegal is it illegal? The court, first of all, is ruling. I don't think the president of the court may tend to be illegal in administering that case. So first of all, I think what is more important is, are we giving the fair hearing to the citizens, yes or no? It's time important to believe, yes or no. First of all, I think the problem starts with the interpretation of the 14 days. The PF as a party, 14 days ends on Friday last week, which is second. UPN ends on the 8th. So which one is right? Then we have the, first of all, preliminary ruling. But I think when again the citizens came to apply to say it was unfair, the court went to review their ruling, and the president ruled now, I can't say in favor of the opposition, the president of the court ruled in favor of the citizens who thought their rights were undermined by the courts. The courts are supposed to protect the rights of citizens within the confines of the law. I think that is what the court needs to explain on Monday, so that the people must understand why the court can come up with a judgment now And after two, three hours, they changed the judgment.
Some people are saying that the judges rather exacerbated the anxiety and tension in the country by extending beyond the 14 days that it ruled that this matter should be dealt with. And they said that the judges allowed the UPND to undermine its very ruling because of the tactics employed in court with their lawyers leaving the court and allowing Hakainde Hichilema and GBM Geoffrey Mwamba to defend themselves or present their case in court. What is your take on that?
I think, first of all, Peter, what you must understand is the PAP also are distracted. The strategy was that they didn't want to allow for them, UPND not giving the evidence in court. It's a strategy, and that was a good strategy. So lawyers, by the way they are, they always come up with a strategy. I don't want to blame the UPND lawyers' strategy to leave the court. I think what we should say is inconsistent in the judgments that are coming out from the court. We must have courts that are not compromised. And by the way, I also told you to say, what if the court ended the judgment by ruling against the UPND by closing the judgment on Friday at 23:45 at its very promise? It was going to mean that one group of the society has not been given the fair hearing.
Louis Mwape is the executive director for the Zambian Council for Social Development. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The opposition in Gabon is disputing the re-election of incumbent President Ali Bongo Ondimba. This after main opposition leader Jean Ping alleged voter irregularities and fraud. According to a new analysis by Afrobarometer, behind Gabon's eruption in post-election conflict, its citizens are among the strongest in Africa in their support for multi-party democracy and their rejection of non-democratic alternatives. Peter Pinard, the lead author of the Afrobarometer report, told me Gabon ranks near the top in favoring multi-party competition and term limits on precedent, as well as in disapproving of one party and one man rule.
Well, what's really interesting that we see in our data and looking at Gabon and our most recent findings, we find that people are very concerned about the freeness and fairness of elections, showing that of the 36 African countries that we surveyed, Gabonese people have the lowest amount of trust in election institutions. 74% have little or no trust in their election commission. In terms of democratic beliefs, we see that in contrast to people's concerns with elections, that Gabonese, as you said, are very much embracing elections as a means of democratic governance and democracy more broadly. So those ideals are firmly in place for Gabonese people.
Well, but Peter, isn't there a discrepancy here? They don't trust the Electoral Commission to administer credible elections, yet they embrace multi-party democracy. How do they expect things to work then?
Well, that's a great point. And that's what we see, that large gap between what people really have learned to and come to think about democracy and elections, where, as you sort of alluded to, 80% of Gabonese people support multi-partyism, which, to put that in context, is second only to Ivorians in the level of support and way above the 36-country African average of 63%. So you see that far and away, that commitment to multi-partyism, and it's equally strong for democracy. So 68% of Gabonese say democracy is preferable to any form of government. And 9 in 10, you know, support, you know, term limits on the executive for president. So you see this strong impulse in support of democratic ideals. But then that gap is really widened. You know, how are elections functioning in this piece? And when we look at that, you know, the actual quality of elections, how they assess how those go in their country and historically, is very low. And so there's that large gap. But at the same time, we see that Gabonese people haven't given up despite the fact that elections have been poorly run in their country. They haven't given up on elections.
The issue of the Bongo family having to rule nearly half a century in that country also brings kind of a question about it, because Bongo Odimba, the younger Bongo, has just been re-elected, although the election is being disputed. Why do you think there hasn't been a total rejection of this family if they think that there should be presidential term limit with power residing in one family for nearly half a century?
Well, that's a great point. So we see 9 out of 10 Gabonese, 92% supporting these two term limits in office. And that's second, again, only to Benin at 93%. So that's such a high consensus. That's a consensus position about term limits. But at the same time, as you mentioned, the Bongo family in one form or another has been in power since independence. And, you know, part of that has to do with how elections act and how elections can actually be manipulated to achieve certain outcomes. And the European Union, for example, is questioning some of the results now, and obviously the opposition is, particularly what has been going around, the figures of the 99% on turnout in the president's home era. And having been an election observer before, and you can see that, you know, vote manipulation and things of this place can actually influence outcomes. And so even though we see more regular elections in a country, in this case Gabon, that doesn't ensure that those elections will actually have a changing effect. And in fact, it's quite possible, although we don't have data or any support for this, that, you know, the results may have been one way or the other. I don't want to speculate right now. You know, there's an obvious discontent with how elections are run and a clear concern that, you know, votes aren't counted fairly, which is a big issue, and that the opposition is impeded from contesting elections openly.
Did the respondent tell you about how credible the legal structure is, or the judicial, or how independent the judicial system is to adjudicate situations of electoral dispute like we have now?
Unfortunately, we actually don't ask that question about electoral disputes. Dispute resolutions process, and I'm speaking from my own sort of expertise on election subjects, have not really yielded much different or effective results across African countries. So this bar of evidence that's required in disputes resolution is so high that very rarely do we ever see situations across African countries of disputes resolutions really addressing issues in elections. And there's a reason for that. That's because election and a lot of the malfeasance that may take place in elections is fairly well hidden from public view.
Peter Pinar is the lead author of the Afrobarometer report. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Michigan. A new United Nations report warns restrictions on freedom of expression threaten Somalia's political transition to democracy after decades of conflict and violence. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva on the launch of the report produced jointly by the UN Assistance Mission in Somalia and the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The 48-page report documents widespread violations in Somalia against journalists, human rights defenders, and political leaders, including numerous killings, arbitrary arrests and detention, intimidation and closure of critical media outlets. Cecile Puy is spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She tells VOA these targeted violations are aimed at squelching freedom of expression and critical opinion. She says Al-Shabaab rebels prohibit all journalists from operating in areas under its control and target media workers across the country. But she says federal and state security forces pose the greatest threat to media workers and political activists.
It's a key concern that remains in Somalia that journalists cannot operate more freely. And over the last 6 months, there is a new trend that seems to appear in a couple of states in Somalia, which is that journalists are being harassed in the street and physically and verbally abused by unidentified men. So we really fear that this is a danger for journalists, for freedom of expression, and for democracy at large.
Over the past 4 years, the report notes 30 journalists and 18 parliamentarians have been killed in Somalia. It also documents 120 cases of arbitrary arrest and detention of media workers between January 2014 and July 2016. Puyi says such crimes are rarely punished because Somalia's judiciary is very weak.
One of the key concerns is about the independence of the justice system, because it's still very much guided by clan-based politics. It also suffers from corruption. There is very limited oversight. And as a result, there is very limited accountability for all the violations of freedom of expression.
Puyi says clan elders also are the main obstacle to women's participation in political and public life. She says the Somali government has seen the report and is taking its findings and recommendations seriously. Puyi says the UN is encouraged by this response and is urging the authorities to take quick action to ensure freedom of expression and to make Somalia a truly participatory democracy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Observers say the Southern African Development Community, SADC, could intervene in Zimbabwe if public protests intensify and refugees start streaming into neighboring nations like South Africa. One observer is Mlamuli Nkomo, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. He says SADC appears to be haunted by its previous interventions in Zimbabwe, which may have failed to deliver the desired results. Reporter Gibbs Dube spoke to Mr. Nkomo and also to a member of the Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF parliamentarian Joseph Chuma about the possibility of a SADC intervention. Nkomo says SADC should take immediate steps to end the crisis in that country.
SADC mandated Thabo Mbeki and later Jacob Zuma to mediate in the Zimbabwean situation. That resulted in the government of national unity and also in the elections of 2013. So with that in mind, it would be admission of failure if we are to see SADC actually intervene in less than 4 years. It will be them admitting that actually they failed in the previous intervention. So this time, it will need maybe a powerful country like South Africa to say we have now been overwhelmed by the influx of people due to the security situation or the economic situation in Zimbabwe. But as long as South Africa is still content with the situation in Zimbabwe, we are not likely to see any intervention, from SADC.
Honorable Juma, we see that the situation in Zimbabwe is really precarious, So what is your reaction to what Mr. Nkomo is saying?
SADC, they are mandated to follow certain laid down rules of how they intervene and how they engage different member states of their bloc. So in this kind of view, you realize that Zimbabwe right now is a constitutionally elected government. So it then therefore becomes difficult for the bloc to come in and intervene in the domestic politics and situation of Zimbabwe, unless it were to go into a full-blown civil unrest or something of that nature.
Do you agree with that, Mr. Nkomo?
I would agree. But what I would say is that if the situation like this continues, there is no other way than to see SADC intervening. Like, if you look at the recent incidents that happened, we saw a tear gas canister being thrown into a moving combi. You don't have to be a security expert to see that there is something wrong with a police officer throwing a tear gas canister onto a moving combi. In as much as Honorable Chuma will say that the incidents of police are not reported by the media when corrective measures are being implemented, we welcome the police information department giving information to the public as to what happened to the police officer who threw a tear gas canister into a moving combi. What has happened to police officer who kicked an old woman. If the situation continues like this and there are no signs that the government is in control of its own police in terms of restraining police brutality. We are going to see more protests, people protesting specifically against police brutality, not necessarily against the economy or against the but against the police brutality. And if the police continue being heavy-handed or being very brutal, one way or the other, violence delegitimizes the government. If you are a government and you always want to use violence and not dialogue, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether you are elected or not elected. Violence is not an instrument to govern. So if the more we see the violence, the more the prospect of public intervening.
That was ZANU-PF parliamentarian Joseph Chuma. You also heard from Lamu Lunkomo, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. They were speaking with VOA reporter Gibbs Dubey. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, mental health disorders constitute 14% of global disease worldwide, but almost three-quarters of this burden occurs in low- and middle-income countries, where a shortage of trained personnel and other resources leave enormous populations with little or no access to mental illness treatment. Sitawa Wafula is the founder and executive director of My Mind, My Funk, a mental health information and support Herb, which runs Kenya's first free mental helpline. For VOA, Ruben Chiama asked her to talk about her journey and how she ended up getting involved in mental health care.
When I was 17, in my final year of high school, I was diagnosed with epilepsy. Then when I was just about to get to university, I had a repo deal that went on unchecked for some time because we were still coming to terms with the epilepsy diagnosis. So I have a dual diagnosis of epilepsy and bipolar, which is a mental health condition based on the unchecked trauma from the repo deal. From my own personal experience, I saw that we don't really have proper information or proper places as a country and even as a continent on where to learn about mental health issues. And for those of us who are able to get proper diagnosis, there's no proper follow-up. Even the person who gives you the diagnosis don't tell you about the side effects. They don't tell you about the symptoms that you show because of your illness. Just from sharing all this online through my blog, I found a lot of people writing in and telling me they're also going through the same thing. That's how My Mind, My Funk grew from my blog to something that was not just helping me and my journey, but also other people and their journey. Then when I won the Google Award, I used that money to start a text line for people. And within the first year, we'd helped around 11,000 people.
What are the most common types of cases that you are handling?
The most common cases we get are depression. Looking at the way life is, especially for Kenyans and Africans, because I deal a lot with people both in Kenya and across the continent, is this whole issue of we want to be 24-hour economies. Everybody wants to be the greatest or the best in a certain field. So a lot of stress and burn down that leads to depression, and a lot of unchecked depression that further leads to suicidal ideation. So a lot of people writing in and saying that they feel that have no reason to continue living and they want to take away their lives. We also have cases of schizophrenia. To some people, it's very severe. So this may be either a parent or a partner who's asking for help on that person's behalf, or someone who's just started experiencing the symptoms and they want to know what is happening to them. Then also cases of drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And something new that I'm seeing, especially among the young people, is cutting, self-harm.
If a client is seriously disturbed, are there psychiatrists who are actually available in Nairobi who can address the issue? And also, do you have medicine available?
In terms of service provision, I can't confidently say how many are in Nairobi, but the countrywide statistics are 79 psychiatrists for a population of 40 million people. That means it's almost one psychiatrist for a population of around 500,000 people, which is so much of a burden. In terms of medication, we still have the same thing. The problem that a lot of people point out to, they say that we don't have so many people coming out to ask for mental health medicine, so we do not stock that medicine. And the reason we don't have so many people coming to ask for the medicine is the mere fact that a lot of people, one, are either scared to be seen that they're going to look for mental health help, because there's a lot of stigma surrounding just the whole sector of mental health. And two is the cost, because we have very few psychiatrists. Most of them have private practices, and the private practice is expensive.
Sitawa Wafula is a mental health crusader. She spoke with reporter Ruben Chiama in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Champions Ivory Coast ensured they will defend their title at next year's Africa Cup of Nations after drawing 1-1 at home to Sierra Leone. Needing a point to qualify, an acrobatic goal from Jonathan Kojia after 37 minutes calmed home nerves. But after Kay Kamara equalized midway through the second half, the tension was palpable. Another away goal would have knocked the 2015 Nations Cup winners out, but they held on despite a nervy finish. Elsewhere, Senegal beat Namibia 2-0, become the only team to qualify with a 100% record for January's finals in Gabon. On Sunday, Niger host Burundi in the group's final match as both play for pride. Mauritania's slim hopes of qualifying for a first-ever Cup of Nations finals were ended on Friday as they drew 1-1 in South Africa in Group M. With Cameroon having already won the group, Mauritania needed a win to have a chance at all of earning one of the two best runners-up places available. The draw means that Mauritania finish in second place with 8 points, and South Africa third, a point behind. The Gambia finished bottom of the table. Also on Friday, the Nations Cup host Gabon came from behind to beat Sudan 2-1 in Khartoum. And Ethiopia kept their faint qualifying hopes for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations alive when beating Seychelles 2-1 at home. The win in both sides' final Group J qualifier takes Ethiopia to 11 points, leaving them with an outside chance of qualifying as a best runner-up. The two best runners-up will join 13 group winners at the finals in Gabon. 1962 champions Ethiopia will need 8 other results to go their way if they are to reach their first Nations Cup since 2013 and only their second since 1982. And Algeria, who finished their campaign against Lesotho on Sunday, had already qualified from the group with 13 points, while Seychelles could only muster 4, a point more than Lesotho. One of the results Ethiopia needed already came in on Saturday night, as Cape Verde, who needed to beat Libya to have any chance of progress, lost 1-0. A home win would have taken Cape Verde 12 points, so eliminating the Ethiopians, but instead the Islanders' dream were left in tatters as the visitors scored in the 89th minute. More qualifiers are scheduled for Sunday. In athletics, more than 1 million applications have been made for the 700,000 tickets available to see the championships at which Usain Bolt and Mo Farah will make their final track appearances. Both will retire after next year's World Championships in London. It will be the final competition for Jamaica's nine-time Olympic champion sprinter, Bolt, who is 30. British Olympic and world 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters champion Farah plans to focus on marathon running after London 2017. The capacity of the championships at the London Stadium in Queen's Elizabeth Olympic Park, which is also now home to Premier League side West Ham United, will be around 50,000 per session. The IAAF World Championships take place from August 4th to August 13th, 2017. Final in tennis, Serena Williams powered to a record 307th Grand Slam match win to reach the fourth round of the U.S. Open. The world number one moved ahead of Martina Navratilova for most match wins in a major by a woman and tied Roger Federer's mark for men with a 6-2, 6-1 victory over Sweden's Johanna Larsson. The American is bidding to claim a 23rd Grand Slam singles title, which would see her surpass Steffi Graf as the most successful woman in the Open era. The six-time U.S. Open champion, whose number one ranking is under threat, next faces Kazakhstan's Yaroslava Shevdova, a 6-2, 7-5 winner over China's Zhang Shuai. Sister Venus Williams, the sixth seed and oldest woman in the tournament at 36, also went through with a 6-1, 6-2 win over 26th seed Laura Siegemund of Germany. She will meet her sister Serena in the semifinals if both continue their winning form. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Some money today. It will be a long, long day, just like any that I ever heard. It will be a hot, hot day, and the rain might come down on me. Oh Lord, I just want a little to get me over, just a tiny, winning little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel alive. Wanna go dancing?
No, yes, I'm gonna go.
I'm going to them pitayo.
No, yes, I'm gonna go.
I'll go dance, girl, musica free.
No, yes, I'm gonna go.
And we can't tell, I'm just singing, yeah.
No, yes, I'm gonna go.
Africa music's so nice, mama. They all go crazy. Maziman tambula diwa, ebiru miyaba sajaba kuno. Katin tambulitia, so they don't go crazy. But I walk the way all the girls walk in Kampala. Moving my body like the girls of Kampala. I just want a little to get me over, just a tiny winning little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel alive. Wanna go dancing?
No, yes, I'm loco.
Nanga cherem piteo.
No, yes, I'm loco.
I'll go dance, girl, musica free.
No, yes, I'm loco.
little to get me over. Just a tiny, weeny little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel, make me feel alive.
Oh, tokuita kuyomba na olaba banga iwe senga kulize hani tetuka olwayo munange obanga gamba tife na yenga kukozechi nesimo tugantuge
Yecho na uchimani naluli na kuorugoye neloto ndavye echiroye kwewe nota nelwe sise tumo mubaka sista wange ya kukume echiro olemeo kutia mungu kuba chisibu nino kufuba no nyansibi tuazine enemera venga echuka ko kale tonyiga tokaba ninda wikienja sente zizo nenze kumilimu
oh no nawe ninda ninda mami dale aha togenda togenda selava numa kunisera sakunze oba jose
Kulowoza konze kanzi chemisinde kulabe ko katono ngende jie oh baby I got to go
olutiko lulolumese nempewo yankomose toneka kuba wanonsiao abankwana bajeyo na yeze na beresa Zenaronda
na mala Nange wento Kwa kala nganzo limunjawa
Nentalu na kuwedu lile lolupe Pwanezo kusana wo
Kangenda ndekana we
Togenda Togenda hani Selava numa
Emirimu watu jeminji
Kulisera Kankulinzi Oba
Kangenda ndekanawe
Togenda
Vamuchejo
Selava numa
Emirimu anti jeminji
Unisera Vankulinze Oba Bize Soka Otuse Atera ogenda
Birungo chiria rasa mukwano Kuma wakutu suzanga tutunula Nekuku ninya nekubungo Ngomu suja Lababwe kukule sawabazate Mama netata boya kare nyo We know kena know yo We wala bolu vanyuma Oh ye ya kulira makama lala Na wene bakuzale walala Lababwe musisinkana Nemutae chama Lababwe mugala nemitima Era nemufuka montomu Evya lavu nga pie unyesa Seba kukira nga geresa Nafunye nange omulonji
kisa okunkube mpeta anti jisiza mikwano na uluganda bagambye titeni mulala taliyo za musula mirozo Samo bia kola omutima ne kuba motefu ne guta yuga nina kusesa mukwano kongera ta kumugondera okufuna balingono chosi changu bame 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 njanja kala talimba anka kasi samo bia kola omutima ne kuba motefu ne guta yuga
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect. In time of conflict, in time of peace, here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Yet again, the African continent is confronted with violence after an election process. This time, it is in Gabon. A week ago, the country held elections for the presidency. The two important candidates were the incumbent Ali Bongo, who had succeeded his father in 2009 and who then was the longest serving African leader. And his opponent was Xi Jinping, who was veteran Foreign Minister of Gabon, and also Chairman of the African Union. After a suspicious long delay, the Electoral Commission in Gabon announced that the incumbent Ali Bongo had narrowly won with about 6,000 votes for a second 7-year term. The opposition was in outrage. And you do not have to be a rocket scientist to know that something rotten was taking place during the counting of the ballots in Omabongo's native province, where the turnout was giving as 99.93%. And with Bongo taking 95% of the votes. Now, there is a background to this. Gabon has a law which provides for mandatory voting. But there is no way you could have such a large turnout in a country where you cannot be certain of the electoral register. Prior to the voting, the people of Gabon had very low trust in the election process or in the Electoral Commission. Because of the opposition to the results, the supporters of Xi Jinping went out destroying many things, including putting fire to the parliament. In response, the government security forces arrested more than 1,000 supporters of Mr. Ping, and the result was there were 5 announced dead Gabonese. The question is, what will be the reaction of the African Union and the wider international community? Already, many countries have supported the call by Mr. Ping for a transparent recount, particularly in Mr. Bongo's province. The government has rejected this call for a recount. In a sanctimonious interview that he gave on Saturday, he was calling on the Gabonese to remain calm. He issued confidence that everything will return to normal soon. I think President Ali Bongo should look no further than the Ivory Coast. We are in a similar situation when Mr. Gbagbo rejected the result that really showed that Lassane Ouattara had won. He refused to listen to the appeals of the international community. The result was a bloody civil war in La Côte d'Ivoire. But where is Gbagbo today? And where is his wife today? And what do you have in now in La Côte d'Ivoire? Ouattara is the president. So I think there should be wiser counsel among those advising Bongo. Either you accept a recount or you will have a tragedy in your hands. There is also a possibility that if things become intractable, one could work out a power-sharing arrangement, not too different from what was done in Afghanistan with the two contestants. In any case, neither the African Union nor the Security Council should allow this outrageous rigging of the ballots in Gabon to last. We have seen too many tragedies in Africa by leaders who refuse to leave office. So let us hope that Bongo reviews his position and listen to the appeal of the international community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Impoga, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the bitter heart eats its owner. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, America pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's strength and prosperity. The notion that work is valued, and even noble, dates to the ancients. Seest thou a man diligent in his labor, the book of Proverbs asks, he shall stand before kings. In the United States, the belief goes back well over a century. As a holiday, the Labor Day celebration began in the 1880s in New York City, with an effort by labor unions to demonstrate the numbers, strength, and spirit of working men and women. They organized parades and rallies, and used the demonstrations to press for new laws to benefit workers, such as standardizing the 8-hour workday. The movement spread to other cities, and in 1894, Congress made it a national holiday honoring all American workers. The association with trade and labor unions has declined over the years. Today, for most people, the holiday represents the last long weekend of summer, a time to relax and spend time with family and friends. There are still parades and rallies, particularly in election years, and also sporting events and picnics. For many, Labor Day means a no-Labor Day before the change of seasons and start of a new school year. Over time, work in the U.S. itself has changed. More Americans now are occupied in offices and services than who toil on the factory floor. The connection between the holiday and the nation's workers remains real, though, as recognition of the source of so much of America's economic and social achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.